Hello, and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. Today I'll be talking with Chris Martinson and Adam Taggart about their new book, Prosper: How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. Chris is surely familiar to listeners as the author previously of The Crash Course. And Chris and Adam are the front-end, back-end team at the peakprosperity.com website. So kick back and enjoy this conversation with me and Chris and Adam as we learn how to prosper in the long emergency. We're going to talk today about your book, Prosper. And one of the pitch lines that you have put out there for the book is that the next 20 years will be completely different from the past. And that's something I think the three of us all believe in. However, the past 7 years since the financial accident of 2008 have been mighty strange, kind of a time of mass sleepwalking into the future, and a time of terrible political leadership and widespread wishful thinking and pervasive ongoing financial fraud. I know that you and I and many other observers have been frustrated by this and by our society's inability to construct a coherent story about what's happening. What's your view of the past 7 years?
Well, I'll take that one, Adam. Then you can jump in and give us your view. Listen, the past 7 years, many people might be lulled by the idea that the stock market is banging around your all-time highs. But all it takes is a tiny bit of curiosity. You peel back the covers, and what do you find? Well, you find that the middle classes aren't doing all that well. The poor aren't doing all that well. That the number of people who are actually in the labor force is just plumbing all-time multi-decade lows. Home ownership is just cratering. Rents are up. Student loans are up. All this stuff, right? It's just a big soupy mess of data that says things are not really going all that swimmingly. But you're right, Jim. What we have is a sort of a collective denial that lays over the top of that and seeks to convince people that everything's okay. I don't know, because the Kardashians are doing this, or Team X won Super Bowl Y, or however we want to put all of this together. And look, shiny things, the stock market's hitting all-time new highs, leaving aside for the moment that one of the most fatal ailments of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor, right? That comes to us courtesy of Plutarch, right? So we're watching all of these things, Jim, that we started cataloging that bothered us in 2007 that led us to put out an alert to say that we think there's big disruptions coming economically, financially. Every one of the things that we track, that we care about, is getting worse or wider, not getting better or narrower, right? Is sovereign debt, is it higher or lower? Ooh, it's a lot higher. Money printing, higher or lower? Ooh, a lot higher. This gap between the wealthy and the poor, much, much wider. And so on. Are derivatives higher or lower? Much higher. Too big to fail banks. They're even too bigger to failer, you know, and so on. So we look at all those things at Peak Prosperity and say, listen, maybe that all continues as is forever for the rest of our natural lives, so we don't have to worry about it, but maybe not. And if not, you know, that's where our work comes in, is helping people understand how to be and what to do when things are this uncertain.
Adam?
Well, I think I'm going to be maybe a little more crass than Chris. I think the national experience over the past 7 years has been akin to basically peeing your pants on a cold day. You know, you feel nice and warm. It solves your problem in the short term. But then very quickly, you realize it maybe really wasn't a very good idea at all. And you're a lot more miserable. We have pulled a lot of, or we've been enjoying a false prosperity where I really believe that what we've been doing has been pulling benefits from the future and diminishing benefits from the future into today. And so, yes, the stock market has been high, but that's largely because of all the liquidity that's been forced into the market and the accounting chicanery with stock buybacks and whatnot. So, you know, things look like they're doing great, but basically we're just taking future value and bringing it, clawing it into today, leaving less for us in the future, and socially as well. You know, we're enjoying this sort of false sense of importance through our celebrity worship and the false popularity of social media. And certainly on the resource side of things, and I think the shale oil story is probably the best example of that. Again, we are enjoying a glut, and I'm saying that with air quotes, of some resources right now, but it's simply because we've learned or convinced ourselves to strip them out of the ground faster, but it doesn't mean that we're producing anymore in the long run, and we're just going to hit the downside of the depletion curves that much faster. So, you know, it's in the short term, some people can look to it as you know, as a boon, but it's the same kind of boon that when your pants are filled with warm urine, it ends quickly.
Well, since you mentioned it, can we just talk for a minute about the fall of oil prices?
Sure.
And how the low price of gasoline at the pump right now has left people confused about our energy predicament. So will shale oil make it possible for Americans to drive to Walmart forever? Because that's sort of the master wish out there.
Yeah, I'll take this one. So look, we know that shale oil is there. We know that it requires a much higher price to get out of the ground. The headlines will never tell you this. The headlines just talk about good old American ingenuity and the United States is about to surpass Saudi Arabia. We're the next Saudi Arabia. It's true. We actually have a lot of oil locked in this shale formations all over the U.S., but it's very expensive to get that stuff out. And that's just on dollar terms, right? People are still not fully accounting for the damage that happens to the roads, the infrastructure, to the environment. You know, there's all these pads. If you've ever taken an overflight and looked down and seen all these mysterious one-acre scrape outs, these little rectangles all across America. Those are shale pads. And then there's all the fracking fluid, which hopefully stays way down deep, but we know it gets blown back out into these open-air pits as part of the a process, and where a lot of it volatilizes and drifts off. And so we're doing all this damage and drilling really deep to get stuff that, Jim, you know this as well as I do, that you drill these wells and they produce maybe, I'll make a generous number up, 1,000 barrels per day for the first month. And within 3 years, it's producing maybe 5 to 15% of what it originally did. So these wells have to be drilled. You have to keep drilling them. And as soon as you stop that drilling program, oh my goodness, you know, the shale miracle, air quotes, is over. So we look at these and just economically, we can say none of these companies were actually earning positive cash flows. Even when oil was 100 a barrel, they're an absolute disaster here at 50 a barrel or 44 or 41 or whatever we are when this goes live. And so we're seeing now the complete destruction of this industry from a financial standpoint. But what we're not seeing is the banks cutting their loans yet, or investors, in air quotes around investors, stopping their habit of throwing billions and tens of billions at these companies as they buy up junk debt and snap up new equity issues. If you wanted a perfect little microcosm to help you understand the larger bubble insanity, just look at the funding for the shale industry. It's a pure economic destruction machine, and it has plenty of capital still.
Okay, well, thank you for going into that, because I know people are having a real problem with it. Okay, that's where we've been, and I want to talk about where we're going now. Why did you release this book now, Prosper, especially at a time when people are having such a hard time prospering in this economy?
Adam, why don't you take that one?
Sure. The mantra that we use at Peak Prosperity, as you started the conversation with Jim, is that the next 20 years are going to look very different from the past. That's a prediction that we've got a great deal of confidence in. And as we like to say, it's not so much a prediction as it's really just math. Now, of course, the proof in the pudding is exactly when are we going to see those changes begin to materialize. And because we've lived in this sort of 7 years or more of sort of fantasy land post-2008, we know that we're at least 7 years closer to the arrival of these trends than of course, we were, you know, starting in 2009. We're also seeing, as Chris mentioned earlier, a manifestation of a growing number of data points of evidence that suggest that the party is indeed ending. And in fact, Chris and I were talking last night. We were sort of using the analogy where it's like it's the point of the party where The alcohol's run out. The music has shut off. And yet you get a stubborn bunch of people that have yet to get off the dance floor. Mm-hmm. But you know that they're turning the lights off and you know, maybe even there's a police car or a cruiser or two pulling up into the driveway, and that the party's going to end relatively soon. So we want to make sure that people take prudent actions in advance of these arriving trends that we're talking about, you know, that are going to manifest in, you know, increased volatility in the financial markets and, you know, horror of horrors, actually maybe a down year in the stock market. You know, we're going to see some scarcity reemerge again and some of the critical.
At this point in the podcast, I lost about 10 seconds of Adam Taggart's voice in the Skype system. So it's going to sound a little disconnected here, but I'm just going to continue on.
Both in terms of class friction, age friction, age demographic friction, but also just sort of general frustration with you know, people not, you know, being able to live the type of lives that they want to live. So, you know, the best time to prepare for hard times like that is not as they arrive, it's before they arrive. And so as we're seeing these signs of approaching disruption, we want to try to wake as many people up to, you know, what exactly is going on, but more importantly, give them really concrete guidance as to steps they can take today that are going to make them much more resilient when everything manifests in force.
Let's talk about resilience a little, Chris.
Well, resilience is something we define in the book, you know, start with the Oxford definition of it all. And I think people will be familiar with the general idea of what resilience is. But what we're angling for is an expanded definition, which might include things like resilience in a business is having a deep inventory, unlike the Walmart model, right, which I know you love to sort of – just in time that, you know, if those trucks stop rolling for a minute, those shelves get stripped clean in, you know, 2 or 3 days, and that's the end of that. It's not a very resilient model, but it's very cost efficient. But we're making the point that this whole idea of our slavish devotion to cost efficiency and just in time is not very resilient. So to resilience, you know, which is the ability to bounce back or weather an insult, we would add resilience is also having a deeper store of variety of things. And so what we do is we borrowed a set of principles from largely from a pair of permaculture gentlemen, Ethan Rowland and Gregory Landua. And they talked about in permaculture how we have 8 different forms of capital. So we're all familiar with financial capital, and we understand that if somebody has a lot of it, they're rich. But we might say, well, we're also rich if we have deep social capital, meaning people we really know, we know them really deeply, not just their names and where they live. We have favors built up with them, that we have a deeper connection, that having that social capital is important, not just to a future of potential disruption, which would be invaluable. We know that from the Zimbabwe experience or any major disruption, knowing people's essential, but it's helpful for you today and how you would.
It's a network of deep social obligation, mutual obligation as well.
Absolutely, and it's built on trust, and it's something that I think my great grandparents would know all about. Something I think we've lost a little to opine, you know, in our current modern so-called hyper interconnected culture, where people don't actually really know anybody deeply, and so by deeply, you know, how does somebody behave when they lose their car keys, and are they good under pressure, and you know, do they really know how to do all the things they say they know how to do, and who are they really when the chips are down, or you know, at a raging party, those are the things you really need to know to develop those bonds. So we've just taken financial capital, and we've added this idea of social capital is another form of capital that you can really work on and you can deepen. And it's one of the things when people say, oh, Chris, all that preparing stuff you talk about, that takes money. True, money helps for certain things in preparing. But guess what? It doesn't really help you at all with your ability to develop social capital. That's a whole different set of skills. It's something anybody could do, rural, urban, rich, poor, young, old, and it takes no money, right? But it does take time. And it takes a dedication to it, and it takes an understanding that this is a good and important thing to do, not just because you're worried about the future. It'll have dividends it could pay in the future, yes, but that's not why we would do it. We would do it because this is a good way to live our lives today.
Now, you guys have a framework for understanding this expanded idea of different forms of capital, many of which are never included in people's thinking or discussions of the matter, especially in the legacy media. So give us an idea of what the eight forms of capital are in your framework.
Adam, you want to take that?
Sure, I'll jump in. So Chris mentioned a number of them there. Let me list them off real quickly. There's financial capital, living capital, material capital, social capital, emotional capital, cultural capital, and time capital, and knowledge capital. Sorry, so I think that's eight there. I can discuss each super briefly. But the key thing to keep in mind here, Jim, you asked about money, and money is indeed one of those forms of capital. It's financial capital. These are what we consider to be kind of the elements for a resilient life, and I think you can also say sort of they're the elements for a fulfilled, happy life, which really at the end of the day is, I think, what most people are looking for. And it's certainly what we care about for the people that are listening to our advice. And we use the word capital because it's fungible, meaning you can exchange one form of capital for another. So money can be very helpful in acquiring certain things in life. And material capital, for example, which is the actual physical things that we acquire. It might be our homes, our cars, tools that we use, et cetera. You know, money is very convenient for buying those things. But you can also acquire material capital through social capital. Chris mentioned that earlier. So, you can basically exchange your services, you can exchange favors, you could exchange looking after a neighbor's kid in return for borrowing their axe splitter for an afternoon type of thing. So when you begin to look at these different areas of your life in which you want to invest your time and energy and deepen the capital you have in each one of these areas, you can ask yourself, well, how do I want to essentially fund that? Do I want to fund it with financial capital? Do I want to fund it with my time? Do I want to fund it with emotional or social support I can give somebody? It's a really interesting way of looking at it because it really begins to diffuse the argument of, I don't have any money and therefore I really can't do any of this. We really begin to realize that we're empowered to strengthen each of these areas of our lives in many different ways. And of course, Chris and I, we know a number of people who are very wealthy in certain areas, but very poor in others. And, a truly wealthy life is somebody who's got sufficient capital in each one of these areas. So, we know a lot of people who have a lot of money, but basically are some of the poorest people we know in terms of quality of life. They let their money define who they are. They live in fear of losing it. And of course, if they see the same trends that we do in terms of the financial repression and other things that are going on in the world that are threatening to our financial capital, they really live in a constant state of anxiety that who they are is going to change over time.
Yeah, it's a very one-dimensional way of being in the world. And I was very interested when I went to your session in Massachusetts 2 years ago about your discussion of living capital, which I know you guys have been working very hard on that yourselves, each, Chris in Massachusetts and Adam in California. So talk a bit about your view of living capital, and
sure,
either of you guys jump in.
Yeah, I'll start and then I'll hand it to Chris. So living capital basically is the living systems upon which you depend, resilient are they? How strong are they? How much can you count on them to be there for you? And of course, the most important living system you depend on is your own body. If that's not doing very well, the rest of the forms of capital don't matter.
Yeah.
So clearly you want to keep your body in a good state of health. You want to try to both avoid sickness, but also to do things that increase your capacity for being able to do things. In a future where, we may need to do more things by hand, as you've written about in your novels, Jim, you want to make sure that your body is fit and capable of being there when you need it to be. So, both Chris and I, who, when we started our journeys from being corporate executives in corporate America to now leading the lives that we lead, you know, we both had the bodies to go along with guys who spent a lot of time in the office, sitting at a desk under fluorescent lights. And when we really developed this appreciation for living capital and how that starts within ourselves, we educated ourselves in terms of, you know, what really are the ingredients for good health. And that's, you know, basically a good level of physical fitness.
Yeah, you know, I didn't meet you before that, but I met Chris a couple of times as he was making that transition. And, you know, when I saw him 2 years later, I was astounded at what good shape he was in.
Well, yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Both Chris and I have gone through our own transformations where I think both of us have lost 30, 35 pounds each and gotten into, you know, much higher levels of physical capability. And, you know, that's been through fitness programs. And for myself, it's been CrossFit. For Chris, I think it's been sort of his own blend that he can talk to, but I think it borrows from a lot of the same principles. But nutrition's a huge one. It's, I think, probably the most underappreciated one. And if you're looking to, you know, lose weight and feel better, nutrition's about 80% of it at least. Then it's, you know, good sleep, which is something that is really kind of an epidemic here in America. We have horrible sleep hygiene. And stress management. There's a lot more information that we talk about on this in the book, but those are kind of those are the crib notes. Chris, do you want to talk about your own journey there?
Well, certainly. I think you've covered the body health just fine, and let me move on to the other part of living capital. Is, you know, Jim, when I look out my window here, I will see a garden, I'll see an orchard. The garden is steadily growing better and better because I'm now become a fan and a student of this idea that I'm a soil farmer. The plants are the adjuncts to that. I don't grow plants. I create good soil. Uh-huh. And if I do that, the plants take care of themselves, really. It's astonishing what a healthy plant can do for you, for itself. And, of course, even the healthiest-looking plant grown in poor quality soil or even dirt, as we farm in agriculturally in this country, is going to look okay, but it's going to be just stripped and devoid of nutrients and micronutrients and all sorts of things that would make it truly healthy. And so I think, Jim, one of the greatest delusions we're living under right now is centered on this disconnection from nature. It's centered on this disconnection from the natural living world. The delusion is rooted in the idea that we can live inside our little boxes and we don't need what's going on out there. We can sort of frown at the Washington Post article that headlines and says, you know, we're losing 100 species of frogs and maybe they'll all go extinct. You know, like, oh, that's frowny time. But it's worse than that. You know, we still depend 100% on the natural world for our existence as humans. And that's not going to change, but it's not just about the survival. You know, one of the pieces we touch on is if you really go about building up the living capital in your space, whether you're on a quarter acre or you've just got a balcony in a high rise somewhere, or you have a little bit more space like some people do. I'm on a little over 2 acres here. There's this second idea that if you really build up the living capital, you end up surrounding yourself with beauty, which gets us back to, I think, something I recognize when I look at architecture from times past or really read about what philosophers concern themselves with. Part of the human experience should be centered on things that are beautiful and functional and give us a joy that's ineluctable. It goes beyond you know, things that we can sort of write down in a notebook or tally up in our checkbook.
Yeah, you know, if I may interrupt for a second, when I talk to audiences, I think it's important to put across the idea that the immersive ugliness of the American landscape must be thought of as entropy made visible. And
yes.
I think that sort of says it all because, you know, entropy is that principle in the universe that moves things towards stasis and death. And I don't think we sufficiently appreciate that.
Well, I think it goes further, too, in that, you know, we have this idea of the broken window policing method, which means that if you live in a community that's surrounded with broken windows and lots of graffiti, those are visible symbols that somehow communicate to people that it's okay to be lawless. And so if you want to live in a place where you have greater safety and more people are obeying the sane laws that do exist, you really can't have the environment trash. So we understand there's some communication between the world we live in and our own self deep down, how we react, you know, whether we're going to be violent or not, apparently is a grotesque expression of that. But what does it mean that we've surrounded ourselves with buildings and with architecture and with plantings that are fundamentally soulless, tacky, and ugly? Well, this is something we explore a little bit in the book, not nearly as deeply or as elegantly as you do, but the idea being that, you know, while we're surrounding ourselves with this living capital, we can be surrounding ourselves with beauty. That has one effect that's all its own. Plus, we get to eat healthier food from healthier plants, and we're creating greater abundance around everything. I plant for pollinators now. I pride myself on the numbers and types of different bees I have in addition to the bees I keep. And so we're actually getting at, Jim, I think one of the most important fundamental narratives that's false that you are asked to believe in as an American, which is that as a human, you're going to destroy stuff. Right? You put enough humans together, the soil goes, the megafauna is dead, you know, eventually there's nothing there but a barren, we turn rainforest into deserts, right? That's part of the narrative. What the permaculture movement and other movements are starting to help us understand is that's one thing that could be true. There's another truth that exists, which is that humans can be accelerants of abundance. We can build up topsoil faster than nature. We can accelerate the creation of a mature canopy in a forest by being clever. And so there's ways we can use our human cleverness to really enhance abundance, not just for humans, but for all forms of life. And in doing that, we create all of this beauty and abundance. And so that's really at the heart of this is Adam and I are really, you know, we're more concerned about shifting the narrative that we're living by, because the narrative of endless growth, mindless consumption, and building ugly, crappy stuff is one narrative that we could live by. But why? Why would we choose that?
We don't have to be agents of entropy.
We don't.
And what you discussed, would you put that in the folder of emotional capital, or is there more to emotional capital than that?
Well, emotional capital is possibly the most important one. And the way we intro that story is by noting that there was already a major economic superpower that collapsed. And that was the former USSR in 1989, dissolved into Russia and a bunch of satellite states. In Russia, in the 8 years after that collapse, up through 1997, they cataloged, you know, why did people die? Well, 54% of all deaths in Russia in that eight-year span were recorded as being due to alcohol in some way. Right now, Russia has a good, strong drinking culture, but 54% is 50% more. Like average for a country like the United States would be 4% of deaths might record related to alcohol. So what happened? Why did over half the people who did die drink themselves to death? And the answer was they didn't have emotional capital. There was this dissolution of USSR into Russia and the satellite states. It was a period where a lot of people lost their jobs. But hey, it's Russia, right? Government housing, government food. Nobody's under a bridge starving like you. What happened to you if you're a homeless veteran in the United States, right? Thanks for your service, right? But in Russia, people just lost the thread of their narrative. They were mostly middle-aged men, like Dmitry the pipe fitter's like, well, I don't have a job, so I guess I'll drink. And so because they had the wrong narrative, which was I no longer have use because I can no longer provide and protect, they chose to just numb themselves. And it turned out, in retrospect, we understand that that period in Russia was one of the most exciting periods of capital formation in its whole history. Now, whether it was done rightly or wrongly, and we can talk about oligarchs, all of that, the truth is there was an extraordinary opportunity that arose at the same time that big crisis struck. And
good
so
point.
The emotional capital part we like to bring across in the book is times are going to get tough, but if your vision focuses down and you can't surf that particular wave, it's going to be really hard and you might as well drink yourself to death. But there will be extraordinary opportunities opening up at the same time.
I think, if I may say, especially opportunities to find purpose, individual purpose in life. Adam, did I interrupt you?
You did not, but right there you put your finger on something that that I put a lot of emphasis on, which is purpose. We've actually written another book in the past that focuses on how to help people actually surface what their purpose is, because that's a fairly existential question that is easy to ask but sometimes hard to answer. But it's really at the core of what we're trying to do with this book, which is to give people purpose and meaning and be able to step into these future changes that are coming. I mean, the one thing we can have confidence in is the change itself. Exactly what type of change, we're not entirely certain exactly how it's going to play out or when. But the importance is, hey, no matter what the future brings, let's make sure that when you wake up in the morning that you are excited and fulfilled by what you're going to be spending your day doing. That's kind of a nice segue into the knowledge capital area, which we describe as the marriage of what you know and what you know how to do. And as we move into an uncertain future, a premium is going to be placed on the doers, on the people who actually have valued skills and knowledge and can actually get things done. And we're big fans of encouraging people to play to their strengths, to focus their energies on their passions and on their natural aptitudes, because you're going to do your best work, you're going to be the most productive, create the most value, and you're going to enjoy what you're doing the most. And what's important about that is, even if the money doesn't come, even if you're doing work that for whatever reason isn't getting adequately compensated, or is probably is more likely, there is going to be a lot of devaluation of wealth out there due to either the sins of the central planners or just general natural deflationary forces, which we do feel is kind of going to be the next chapter on the economy side of things. You know, if you even if the money doesn't come, if you are living a life of purpose and using your time valuably in a way that fulfills you, you know, then you're doing fine. You are living your days with meaning. And we talk to so many people, sadly, who even in the relative tranquility of these past 7 years are living lives that have no meaning for them. They feel like they are, you know, latched to the rat race hamster wheel and just slaving away in a soulless corporate existence. And to be honest, you know, that's one of the reasons how we talk about these different forms of capital and true wealth. Yes, you might be making an income that helps you make your mortgage afford some creature comforts. But if you're hollowed out emotionally, if you're really, you know, living a purposeless life, that's not real wealth.
Well, speaking of knowledge, you guys have both been homesteading for a few years and, you know, raising chickens and other animals and gardening and doing orchards. You didn't start out with this knowledge. You had to acquire it. And am I correct?
Yes.
And what was that journey like?
I'll let Chris jump in right here in a moment, but it's certainly been a learning experience. But as Chris was talking earlier about sort of beauty and joy in life, it's completely a joyful one. There's definitely this connectedness to nature that, you know, many of us, myself included, who I lived much more of a suburban lifestyle beforehand, we're really divorced from in this world where we have all these energy slaves working for us and allow us to live, the general suburban happy life. But getting back to nature, really understanding how nature works, there's definitely something that is primal within us, I think, that gets awakened by that. But an important thing to underscore as well is, as we enter times that are going to be more challenging, and that'll be on a variety of fronts, but basically it just means that things won't work as they have always worked for us in our past memory, we're going to have to learn how to do more things ourselves. And that learning process is very trial and error based. So you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And of course, mistakes there's something that are kind of vilified in our modern educational system, but they're how the human brain works. We're neurologically wired to think about doing something, do it, see how it worked, reflect on what we could do better, and then do it again and iterate like that. And so, this process of learning how to garden and learning how to create orchards, you know, has initially largely been a path of learning how not to grow things and then figuring out what's not working and fixing it. And the big thing that I want to underscore here is the time to be making those mistakes is now, right? Where things still work pretty much the way that we were used to. There's a lot of support systems in place. You can still, you know, run down to your big box grocery store if you, you know, happen to kill your entire garden this season. you don't want to be learning through those mistakes in a time of crisis where you really need those things to grow. You're depending upon those calories to come. That's not when you want to, you know, realize that you've, you know, you're starting off with a brown thumb.
Where were your skills at, Chris, when you retired from corporate life?
I would say I was a C-minus gardener, and that was about the only skills I had at that point in time. And I didn't really, Jim, I got to be honest, I didn't come into this saying, oh, I have all these skills I have to learn. The truth was I became curious, and I wanted to figure out how to begin to resume control over things I could. So the basics, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I was on the bottom rung of that pyramid. You know, I just wanted to know how I could keep my family warm, safe, sheltered, fed, water. So I just started figuring some things out and started attending to each of those things. And it was a little tactical at first. Like, it was very sort of fear, survival oriented. You know, that was my prime motivation. As I got deeper into it, I started to realize that this new lifestyle that I've come to is something I would run towards. It's not that I was running away from something. And for both my family, my wife, we really love this. And so here's just like a quick anecdote around this. My kids now, because they've grown up in this way and we've required them to have chores and to really work, now as they're entering the workforce, my son is 17, but as a 16-year-old, he went out and started working with this landscaper, stonemason kind of guy, sort of catch-all, does, you know, mows lawns, builds walkways, whatever. And this guy had the usual experience of hiring young people. He rotates through them remarkably quickly because none of them like to work or know how to work. And my son Simon just fit in, and this guy started having more and more work. And then Simon did a little bit of side work for this other person, and soon he was in a bidding war. Or the one guy was wanted to pay him more, and the other guy wanted him. So I asked each of them, like, why would you, you know, why do you like this guy? And they're like, well, he's smart. He knows how to work, and he pays attention, and he's really like he's just, he's not afraid of doing the work. He actually gets some joy from it. And so that's really where I'm at with this now. This idea of acquiring skills and knowledge and doing what's happened at my little mini homestead. It's just a product of being curious and really enjoying it and doing it as intelligently as possible, which, by the way, still means I make a lot of mistakes, right? So that's just all part of it. But it's the effect on my children, I didn't really appreciate until they went out into the world and we got some feedback from it. I think it twanged a string in there that's just ready to learn in a certain way. And humans learn by doing.
What are some of the principal practical steps that you'd advise people to take to build their resilience through what may be a period of hard times ahead?
Ooh, well, the book is the place to start because, you know, we did synthesize a lot in there, but it all begins with having a plan. It begins with really taking stock of where you are. It's you know, we have a way of mapping so people can map themselves into these eight forms of capital. And out of all of them, you can do something about all of them. Cultural capital, not a lot you can do about that one except move, right? If you're in Oakland and you don't like the culture of Oakland, yeah, you might as well just move. You know, it would be our advice in that particular case. But except for that one, where, again, you still want to take stock and understand the culture that you're in or this microculture that's available to you. We would say you have to start by understanding where are you strong, where are you weak. And you're going to begin possibly for most people with your financial situation and really take stock of that. Get yourself, you know, understand your balance sheet, your income statement, your cash flow statement, like do the hard work of figuring all that stuff out. Keep some of that in reserve as your investments and your savings, but dedicate a portion of that to spreading out across the other forms of capital where it makes sense, right? So you can spend money on living capital, material capital, knowledge capital, things like that, and then have a plan. And so, you know, our advice to people is don't be overwhelmed by the sheer number of things you might think you need to do. It's to develop that plan, and then it starts here. You just do the next thing.
Adam, like,
what's the first thing on your list?
What's more important, have a big pile of money or have a good plan?
Oh, golly. As Chris said, it's to start with a plan. And just to dispel the notion that you need a big pile of money to do all this, you certainly don't. It could help. But building resilience is something that anybody can do, regardless of their net worth, regardless of their age, regardless of their socioeconomic status. So definitely start with the plan. And as Chris mentioned, we lay out the framework for all of this in the book Prosper that we're talking about here. The end of the book then mentions our What Should I Do guide, which, you know, as we talk about these big events that are going to shape the future, what should I do is the most common question we get. And actually, that's why we wrote Prosper. But think about Prosper as sort of the 30,000 level to about the 2,000 level view. And then, of course, at the individual level, it begins to become much more specific about your own particular personal situation, which is why we created this online guide, it gets much more granular in terms of recommending not only sort of specific directions to head into, but in many cases, specific products that you should be looking to acquire for your household, specific steps that you should be taking with your money, specific strategies for developing, say, you know, social capital in your community. So, in addition to considering picking up the book Prosper, come to our website to peakprosperity.com/whatshouldido, and you can get that very granular handholding that's going to be very helpful for you in building your own customized plan.
Now, this book isn't really a paranoia-based book about a fearful future. We are facing a future that's very uncertain, that is liable to be very different from what we have been familiar with. But it seems like a pretty hopeful book, at least at the individual level. How would you guys counsel people who are fearful about the future?
Well, I think a lot of people are fearful, and rightly so. We find in our work that people who are fearful are there for a reason, and that's because they know enough about the direction things are heading, so they've got information, but their actions aren't aligned with that. So you live in fear. We might say somebody who lives on top of the San Andreas Fault and has zero preparations for an earthquake, no 48-hour emergency kit in the closet, even though that costs about $100, right? They have no plan developed with their family for knowing how they would communicate if the cell towers are down or have a rally point. They haven't done any basic preparation around that, and they try and forget the fact that they live on top of a fault that could deliver an 8 or higher earthquake. And so they live with a certain amount of fear in that to varying degrees, whether they're aware of it or not. And so for people who are particularly fearful, the first thing to understand is that it simply means that they're probably not taking any action. So this is where just do the next thing comes in, which is, you know, our approach, which is as soon as they're moving and really beginning to take control, listen, we can't possibly know what's going to happen, when or how much, any of that stuff. The future is completely unpredictable in that way. But we can know if we're exposed, that if we don't have the appropriate forms of insurance, baked into our lives, not actual insurance products, that might be part of it. But I mean, you know, the forms of insurance of having a deep pantry, of being physically fit, of all these other things we've just been talking about.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I know that you have kids who are really moving into adulthood. Adam, how old are your kids?
14 and 9. So we're a few years behind Chris's kids, but we're beginning to wrestle with those ideas, yeah.
But what do you advise them about that journey into adulthood? And I'm thinking especially about the issue of college, because college, to some extent, has become kind of a joke, you know, especially given the racketeering traffic in college loans. Just this week at an elite college, Amherst, in Massachusetts, the students were inveighing against free speech. So what the heck is going on out there with college, and what would you tell your kids about it and the value of it?
Boy, I think we're going to have a very, very different sort of a response to that. Look, college is an absolute must-do, no-brainer in my family. This goes way back in my family lineage. So of course you go. Of course I did. I went through more college than anybody ever should, and with a PhD and an MBA.
Maybe we'll take it back, Chris.
So here we are. My oldest is 21, and she went to 2 years of community college, and then is deciding should she go to the rest of a 4-year school, and it's unclear if she will, because she's looked at the whole thing. There's no clear, compelling thing that she's going for. One of the so-called STEM degrees: science, technology, engineering, or medicine. She's not drawn to those where you do need a degree to gain entrance into those particular professions. She's looking at other professions, and so we sat down with her and said, "Look, here's some money set aside for college. It's probably not enough. What would you like to do?" And she said, "Well, that looks like plenty for a down payment on a house. Could I use it for that? Like, however you want to use it, it's yours." So she's deciding where and how she's going to go forward with that. And I'm, you know, there's a part of me which is just bought into the whole cultural story, which really says, oh, you know, college is kind of a must do. But I'm not clear on that anymore, because if she was spending $50,000 a year to inveigh against the First Amendment, I don't know if I would really consider that a worthwhile investment at this particular stage.
Well, it is interesting that she's actually pushing back against such a strong set of beliefs that you have.
Well, she is, and she's really making up her own mind about that. And she has a number of friends who have gone to college at this point in time who have really crushing student debts. And she feels so blessed and fortunate not to be in that position, because she's seeing her friends' life decisions are now shaped by that debt. They have to get a job. They have student loans they have to pay back. There's a monthly nut that's cost more than a fancy car for many of these people on a per month basis, et cetera. So she's looking at how that's shaping their whole lives, and she feels free of that, and delightfully so.
How do you feel about that, Adam?
Oh, I feel that this is a hard topic to address near the end of the podcast, because I could talk all day about it. I've got such strong feelings. I feel very similar to how Chris does, and my approach with my kids is pretty similar to what Chris is doing with his. What I'm really trying to focus them on, in terms of college specifically, is value, which is really what are you looking to get out of it, and what is the cost going to be to you? And let's make sure that whatever your decision, whether it's to go to a big name school, to do the junior college for 2 years thing, or whether it's not go to college at all, you know, let's look at it in terms of, you know, what investment you're going to make of time, money, is it going to be debt funded or not? And what do you expect the value you get out of the experience? I do think for way too many people, college has become this rubber stamp. It's more of a social experiment or experience than an educational one.
Yeah.
Kids graduate pretty much with a piece of paper and a lot of fun memories, but they don't. What they don't have, Jim, and this is really where it's at the heart of the problem of the educational system, is they don't have any mastery, right? They really don't know. The vast majority of them don't know how to do anything. Most of them are going to go into a career that has probably nothing to do with their major, and they're going to learn how to do something from scratch. And you don't need to pay $40,000 a year for 4 years to do that, particularly if you're racking up $100,000 or more of debt. The statistic I like to mention is, if you go to an average college and take out the average amount of debt, and get an average job, you will be paying off your educational debt until your own children go off to college. Uh-huh. And it's just become a really poor, you know, really negative return on investment for the average student. So what I'm most focused on is helping my children develop a really solid self-understanding in terms of what they want to do with their lives, and what personal strengths and passions that they should be guiding their life trajectory around. And the good news is there are resources out there. We just did a podcast on our own site last week with the Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation, which is an excellent test for contributing to that self-understanding. But there are many others out there, and there's, you know, many different life experiences we're trying to have our kids participate in that help them understand their likes, their dislikes, their strengths, their weaknesses, and whatnot. But when it comes time to leave the home, I want my kids to have enough of a grounding in who they are, what makes them tick, what work they like to do, what work they don't like to do, that they can make really informed decisions about what they do next. And I think that sadly, for way too many kids in America, they are not led through that self-introspection nor helped. And it's just assumed that by the time they get that piece of paper at the end of their 4 years of college, they've had some magic epiphany where the clouds have parted and they know what to do with their lives. And the vast majority don't, which is why the research says, you know, well over 70% of American workers don't like their jobs. They would totally change professions if they could, but they had, you know, no informed clue when they were graduating from school. So they just went and got a job that society told them was good. It was probably the industries that were hiring most that year or where their friends were going. And that's just a recipe for waking up in your mid-40s saying, boy, I really don't like what I'm doing, but I'm stuck. I got a mortgage. I got kids now. I've got debts. And this is all I know how to do. And it's really a recipe for getting trapped. And if at all possible, I want to help my kids avoid that.
Yeah. Well, we are nearing the conclusion here. I wonder, before we tell the listeners how to get your book Prosper, do you have any concluding thoughts, things I might have failed to touch on?
Well, no, you started to ask what I think is an important question, which is, you know, is this book about the fear that we might see in the world, or is it about, lack of a better word, is this the doomer approach? And it's very much not. Adam and I consider ourselves to be realistic optimists. So let's be realistic about where we are. I know you're very realistic, and I'm sure your listeners are as well. We're data-driven people. We look at the data and we say, there's not that many ways to conclude this. I mean, just, you know, look at the demographics in Japan or our underfunded entitlement programs. You know, it doesn't take a genius to say, wow, problems are, you know, that's going to be a problem someday. And so our position is, okay, with that realistic understanding, how can you be optimistic? Well, the optimism comes from knowing that even if I can't do anything about the Fed printing money, I can do things about making sure that I'm insulated from the effects of that when they come down. So the book is about optimistically taking control of what you can, understanding there will always be opportunities, but it's really a call for the individual to be in the best possible position and shape they can be in so that they will be in a better position to maneuver when the time comes, help people, and be of service, not a drain on what resources exist if a disruptive moment comes.
Adam?
Yeah, and Jim, to that, I would add that, the subtitle of the book is How to Prepare for the Future and to Create a World Worth Inheriting. And, we lay out our framework and all the steps that we think people should take to address the coming future. But the great part about the story here is that even if we are totally wrong about the trends themselves or when they're going to materialize, the steps that we're encouraging people to take are life enhancing. They're catalysts for better living. And they're never going to be bad investments of your time and energies. You are never going to look back and say, I really regret having got healthier and gotten in better shape. I really regret having gotten to know my neighbors better. I really regret not being, you know, prudent with my money and actually growing it over time. These are all things that are going to be worthwhile investments that are going to pay off in your life, even if the status quo continues. And of course, if they don't, then they're going to take a dramatically outsized significance in your life. So we really don't think that following these steps, that there's any downside. And then just to underscore something Chris said earlier, while our lives look very different from when Chris and I were working in the corporate world, if we could back then see how our lives are now, even though some might say that our standards of living are maybe a little bit lower in terms of maybe earning potential and whatnot, the quality of life is so much higher that we would not walk, we would run to this type of future. So to Chris's point about optimism and the call to the individual for a better life, this really is a much, much better way of living. And it's not really about fear. It really is about creating a better tomorrow for ourselves individually and then collectively for all of us as a global community.
Well, I can't think of anything more optimistic than being able to take control of your own life. I've been talking to Adam Taggart and Chris Martinson, the co-authors of the new book, Prosper, How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. And can you guys tell us where the listeners can find the book?
Sure, they can find it anywhere. The book launched yesterday. It's available at major booksellers everywhere, both online and off. There's a print version of the book. There's an ebook, so you can download that to your Kindle or e-reader. There's an audio version of the book, both in CD form, and hopefully by the time this podcast goes live, it'll be available for download on audible.com. So however you like to consume your media, we got you covered.
And you guys are also found at the peakprosperity.com website, where you have a lot of additional information about how to get on with your life and take control of it. And Chris, Adam, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's been an honor, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and we will ride again.